Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, I want to welcome Mark D'Antonio. He is an astronomer and the Mutual UFO Network's chief photo video analyst. He is CEO of FX Models, a model making and special effects company specializing in digital physical models and organic special effects in the film industry. He has done extensive work in the film and television arena, appearing regularly on a number of networks. His efforts creating UFO TOG-2, a remote UFO detection system with Douglas Trumbull, promises to bring ufology into the 21st century. Mark, welcome. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, how you doing? I'm very well, thank you. Nice to hear from you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I've been looking forward to this ever since I can remember, ever since I was a small child. Outer space and the possibilities of life outside our planet have been a major fascination for me. And the topic, of course, has led me to where I am now, talking to you and doing this every day, talking to fascinating people like yourself. And so much about space is still a mystery, but fascinating discoveries are occurring every day. And like That's the right. discoveries of the existence of all these awesome exoplanets. It yeah. makes it a very exciting time in history.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, it is. So let's get started with a little bit about yourself. Tell us more about your background and what got you started with astronomy.
I knew I was going to be a professional astronomer when I was 9 years old. I went outside and I looked up and I thought, wow, we can't be the only planet. Literally, that's what I thought. So I looked at the sky and I said, I want to learn more about the sky. I want to know more about stars. What are they? How far away are they? And you learn fascinating things along the way. And, like really early on, like when I was maybe 12 or 14, I learned that because the stars are so far away, every time you look up in the sky, you're looking back in time to some level. We look at the stars of Orion, we're seeing them between 700 and 1600 years ago, because that's the time it took their light to get here. And this is very important now with the upper left star in Orion, Betelgeuse, that bright red supergiant, because it's been dimming in a very strange manner, unlike anything we've seen this century. And so that means that whatever happened to cause this dimming actually happened 700 years ago. And the light's just getting here. That light train of all those light signals is still heading our way from far away. And then it gets here, and we see this dimming now. Now, if Betelgeuse goes supernova, we'll see it someday. But maybe it already has. And 700 years from now, we'll see it if it went tonight. If it went 100 years ago, then we'll see that in 600 years, you know, when the light finally gets here. However, if it went 699 years ago, well, we're on the verge of watching the upper left star in Orion obliterate itself and become a beautiful, and I'm sure will be, a gorgeous supernova remnant, you know, which is something which is, I'm really looking forward to it. I hope it happens. There certainly can't be any planets around Betelgeuse that are habitable anyway, because Betelgeuse used to be an O star, one of the hottest, bluest stars in the whole universe. And then as it got older, used up all its hydrogen, swelled up into this giant supergiant that almost the size of Jupiter's orbit. So it's a big star now. But, you know, that's so little things like that. Those little factoids like that are the reason I'm an astronomer. And there's so many more like it. There's tens of thousands of things like that going on in our universe all around us.
Now, you mentioned Betelgeuse. I thought we could start there. Now, sure. We will be able to see the effects. Will this actually cause any physical effects, or will it affect our planet in any way?
It'll affect people's senses of wonder, for sure. Because when Betelgeuse goes, it's going to be a supernova, which is a cataclysmic explosion of a star. After it runs out of its fuel, it collapses and goes boom, and it all bounces off that little core and shoots on out, ripping the star to shreds. The last time it happened in our galaxy Well, one of the main ones actually was the Crab Nebula, which is in Taurus, the bull. And that was in 1054 AD. And Chinese astronomers noted that there was a new star in the sky. And it stayed there for about a year. And they saw it in the daytime as well. So it was very bright. And it changed their culture because they didn't know what to make of this. But they did note this thing there. They couldn't see what we see now, which is this supernova remnant that's actually expanding slowly away from the spot where it blew up. But, you know, it's something that happened only, you know, 1,000 years ago. So we're still looking at an expanding supernova remnant, you know. And but as far as danger, it's not going to pose any danger to us. It's too far away. Now, if it was just a couple light years away, well, yes. We would actually probably be destroyed by that. But there's no stars within a danger distance to us that can actually hurt us.
With the discovery of all these new exoplanets, how close do you think we are actually coming to discovering life on any planet besides ours?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because if you look at how we're made, okay, we're made of carbon atoms. Carbon is really one of the most abundant, you know, elements in the universe. It's not the most abundant, but it's abundant. And it seems that all of the building blocks of life were delivered to this planet and made by the planet. It was an automatic process. Comets, meteorites, asteroids colliding with our planet delivered a lot of these very necessary carbon-based building blocks to our planet. And then the Earth manufactured some of these building blocks itself through its own processes. There was a famous experiment done in the early 50s called the Miller-Urey experiment, which showed that amino acids, the building blocks of DNA, were actually made by the planet automatically through lightning striking the ocean surface and land. That was an interesting discovery, because it shows that maybe life is the rule, not the exception, in the universe. Perhaps the building blocks of life are so very common that it'd be strange not to have life in the habitable zone around the star, where liquid water can be on the surface of a planet. And I think that's why I wrote my book, The Populated Universe, because I wanted to show that, yes, you know, astronomy is a lot of big numbers, but I think it's important that people understand from a different perspective. They can understand where these numbers come from without actually having to understand the numbers. They can still get the gist and understand the meaning. And the book is on exoplanets and extraterrestrial life, the search, you know, for extraterrestrial life. So it's all very meaningful. And finding exoplanets, maybe we're just a few years away from being able to detect another planet that may have an oxygen atmosphere. So that's really all we need. Because if we see an excess of oxygen in the atmosphere of some planet, well, it really means that there's something that's replenishing it, because planets will tend to let that oxygen go down into the ground and bind with all kinds of things. Oxygen loves to bind with other stuff. If there's an excess of it in the atmosphere, like here on Earth, then we know that planet is not in equilibrium. Our planet's not. We have this extra oxygen, which shouldn't be there. So we're actually, we're here because the planet is not in an equilibrium. It's called disequilibrium. It's a strange concept, but that's why we're here. So we're going to look for that disequilibrium elsewhere. And if we find it, well, that could be an interesting day.
When it comes to our solar system, are there any planets or moons that may show promise of hosting any forms of life?
Yeah, we have several. We have several choices in our solar system. Let's start with Mars. Mars actually has liquid water under its south polar cap. There was a large, I think it was a 12-kilometer-long subterranean, I won't say aquifer, but it's actually a a subterranean lake underneath the south pole of Mars, where it's under enough pressure so the waters can be liquid. And maybe there's microbes there. Now, if we continue on out to Jupiter, Jupiter has one moon called Europa, which has a very thick mantle of ice, and you know Europa, and it might also have a 60 to 90 mile deep ocean under that ice. Now, why would we think there's life there? There's no atmosphere in Europa. None whatsoever. But here on our planet, at the deep ocean rifts, we have these hydrothermal vents. They call them the black smokers. There's this black mineral-laden water that methane-eating bacteria just love to gobble up, and that gives rise to other life forms, and then life forms that eat those life forms on up until you have these little oases of life around these hydrothermal vents, until the hot spot under the tectonic plate moves away as the plate moves over it, and that former area, that oasis, becomes a dead zone again. Well, what if we have those on Europa? See, because the life forms in the deep ocean here, unlike all the rest of the life forms near the surface, don't rely on photosynthesis. They don't care about the sun. They're getting their energy from chemosynthesis, a very different way to metabolize material from the world around you in order to gain energy and survive. And so chemosynthetic life at the deep ocean rifts means the possibility of finding deep ocean life on Europa might exist. And if we go further out from Jupiter and Europa, we come to Saturn. And Saturn has a little tiny moon. It's only 310 miles in diameter, but it's called Enceladus. And Enceladus does have hydrothermal vents under its south pole because we saw them. We were able to photograph those hydrothermal vents using the infrared. So could there be life forms there? Microbes? Well, we can't say no, because we know how chemosynthetic life here is tenacious. You know, if you're looking on Earth, every single area on our planet, every single location, whether hospitable or not to us, will have some type of life form there. We'll find life forms inside the hot springs at Yellowstone, right? Inside those glacial pools that are boiling. There's bacteria in there that just love that. We've even found life forms cling to the walls of volcanic craters where there's lava lakes. There's life living on the walls right above the lava lake, you know? Now, certainly not living creatures like us, naturally, but microbial life. So in other words, it's tenacious, and we call those extremophiles, life forms that live in these most exotic, inhospitable locations. And the extremophile life is where it starts. And we're going to look for life like that here in the solar system and perhaps elsewhere.
Now,
there's a lot to do.
You're talking about microbial life. Would there be any possibilities of any more advanced life forms within our solar system?
I would. 10 years ago, I might have said no. Why would I say anything different now? Well, the only reason I would say anything different now is because, with my understanding of the exoplanet world and how many exoplanets are out there, the likelihood that some other advanced life form could have come into existence is to me pretty high. And because it's pretty high to me, I also hypothesize that perhaps they could have made their way here. Now, we're looking for oxygen in atmospheres, so would they, because they may also be carbon-based. It seems to be a template that the universe provides. Every life form on this planet is carbon-based, and every life form has DNA. This seems to be a template, and we're symmetric, you know, from the center line out. The way we interact with our environment is through symmetry, two arms, two legs, two feet, blah, 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 you know. And that might have to do with the way DNA replicates. You know, it unzips, and you get one strand of this, RNA, it's called, and then that gets matched and built up in one of the cellular locations and thus becomes a new strand of DNA, and thus it replicates. Well, it's symmetric the way it's replicating. And perhaps that replication, that symmetry, goes all the way up to the macro form to us. And if that's the case, then I would expect that we would find symmetric creatures out there. We don't have, as I've said before, pogo stick cows bouncing through pastures. You know, it's something, we have symmetry here on this planet.
Now, before we go too far into extraterrestrials, I want to move to the moon a little bit. Sure. The moon has a lot of mystery to it. I'm fascinated with the moon. It's always in a tidal lock with us. We only see one side, and the dark side's always been a mystery. So many conspiracy theories. Yes. Could you explain, help us understand the moon a little bit, help us understand why it doesn't rotate, why we don't see the dark side, and you know, the rumors that it's possibly hollow and there's bases in the moon. Just, you know, maybe address a little bit of that.
Yeah, you know, you've always heard, you know, the moon rings, therefore it's hollow, and they're comparing it to a bell. But the fact is, they should actually compare it to the solid stones in Ringing Rocks State Park in Pennsylvania, for instance. There, when you go there, they give you a hammer. And you can walk around and hit these solid rocks, and they go bing, and they ring because they're solid. So people have to understand, the reason that the moon rings like it did has more to do with the fact that it doesn't have a molten core like the Earth, all right? Or I should say it's a solid core in the Earth with an outer molten core and then a mantle with sort of plastic, you know, plasticky, you know, malleable rock. And solid, so far more pronounced than on the Earth. So as far as the moon being hollow, it's certainly not hollow. This we do know. As far as the tidal locking, well, early on when the moon was formed, and of course we had the theory that it was born from the Earth, right? The Earth got hit by a Mars-sized object probably, and it blasted off a blob, two big molten blobs of stuff. One was the Earth, one was the moon, and when the moon coalesced, the moon was very close to us. And when you have objects that are very close to each other, then there is a little dance they do gravitationally where the less massive one will end up locking one face. Okay, that tidal locking is very common. We actually see it happen with exoplanets that are very close to their star. Mercury has a form of tidal locking. It's so close to the sun. Okay, some of the moons in our solar system around the bigger planets have tidal locking going on as well. So we do see it, all right? Pluto and Charon are tidally locked to each other. So it is a phenomenon that we do see elsewhere. And that's not so strange. It's actually kind of expected based on the mass of the moon and the distance it is from us. Tidal locking makes sense. But the moon is, because of the way the Earth-Moon system is, because we have oceans and a tidal bulge, we are actually giving up a little bit of our energy to the moon every year. And that allows the moon to spiral away from us just a little bit more. And that little bit more is 2 centimeters, about that big. Okay, each year it goes that much further away from us. So you ask the question, well, how long will it be before the moon is gone from the Earth altogether, can escape Earth's gravity? Fair question. If the sun lasted forever, then we could calculate how long it might take, several billion years for the moon to do that. But the sun's going to die long before the moon spirals away. So the moon will be here for the rest of humanity.
Now, when you say the sun will die, you know, that's a concerning statement. But, you know, in reality, how long does this take to occur?
Oh, it'll be over by tomorrow afternoon at 6 p.m. Eastern time.
Right on. I'll be waiting.
No. The sun being the closest star to us is one that we've modeled pretty extensively. One of the things I did when I was getting the astronomy degree was actually modeled the interior of our star. We actually did it from the core all the way out. And we got all the numbers to work right to actually see what's actually happening at every single point inside the star. And that could be for the same type of star, you could kind of extrapolate and compare. Well, based on all that, we've actually been able to figure out that the star our star's lifetime is going to be probably a total of 10 billion years. So we're about halfway into that. We have 5 billion years to go before the sun goes. So, you know, I'd pack a go bag just in case. I'm kidding. There's no need for a go bag. And it, like I said, we have about 5 billion years. And it sounds like a lot of time. But as a civilization on the planet where we can't even agree with each other across the planet, we have a long way to go before we can unify to the point where we say, hey, getting off this planet's a really important thing. Getting out there to other stars is a really important thing. You know, we have people on this planet that don't even believe that there are other stars. So we have a long way to go to get the science out there, which is why, you know, I think I exist. I mean, I'm an astronomy outreach guy. You know, we have SkyTour Live Stream, which is this observatory here in Connecticut, and we do live streams to the world on clear nights. And we're building a second one in Arizona, which is going in starting next month. We're going to be putting the concrete pad in next month, and then the telescope is already here. We're going to be installing it out there in another whole astronomy observatory building, and we run them remotely. So I run the one here from my computer. I don't go out into this observatory. I run it from here. So I'm setting it up to run in Arizona remotely as well, so I can control it anywhere and do presentations and run classes, teach people astronomy, you know, and we do it as on a channel on YouTube, you know, SkyTour Live Stream. And people, oh, actually, it's on my shirt, SkyTour Live Stream. I mean, we actually have quite a following. We have thousands of subscribers, and people are, it's about outreach. So I think it's important to realize that science is for everybody. Not just people who have degrees, not just people who can speak science, but for the average person who doesn't understand a lot of science, it'd be nice to be able to explain something to them so they can understand. And that's what I do. Now, that's my strength, is that I can take the complex and make it understandable, but in a correct manner so that they don't have misconceptions. You see what I mean? So astronomy is very important because it's the rigorous application of astronomy eventually that's going to get the entire human race off this planet as one unified people.
So. Now, speaking of explaining things to where we can understand, I hear online arguments and different theories of the force of gravity versus the electric universe. What is the greater force on the universe? Would actually, I guess, dictate what is going on in our universe more. What are your thoughts on the electric universe theory versus that gravity rules more powerfully?
I have talked to people that have argued that craters on the moon are created through some electrostatic process on the moon and not via impactors. And to me, I think that there might be some validity to the fact that there might be some type of electric universe component to our universe, but not to the extent where craters are created by this process. We clearly see impactor scars. We see remnants of the impactors deep in the crust, okay, like deep under the moon in the Aiken Basin, the lowest spot on the moon. It's a gigantic, effectively, crater. It's over 1,600 miles across on the moon. The moon's only 2,200 miles across. It's a huge place, huge hole that got filled in by lava. Well, there's a giant object deep under that crust, and it's probably remains of this impactor that struck the moon at one point. Now, that could have been the result of a giant blob thrown off the earth when the moon was born. Who knows? But I think that there might be a place for electric universe theory, but I'm not convinced that all the things I hear about it, especially regarding making of craters, is valid. You know, we can calculate the force of gravity. We can see what gravity is doing. And our standard model of physics operates within the framework of gravity, you know, the force of gravity. And I think it's important that until something comes along to plug the holes we have in that model, which we have holes, I think that we should then consider that it's valid until something better comes along, until something can be shown provably to be a better way. And so far, I haven't seen that. That's just me.
Very fair enough. Now, are we in, or are we entering a grand solar minimum? And if so, could you explain a little bit more about that? And is this something to be concerned about with space weather and anything that we should be concerned about in the near future?
Well, as you allude to, you know, the sun does have maxima and minima. Every 11 years, we have the sunspot cycle. This corresponds to where the magnetic field lines of the sun are actually getting twisted up in the sun as it rotates, because the equatorial region of the sun rotates much faster than the polar regions. Okay, so this is rotating faster. And so the magnetic field lines get pulled and twisted around. And every 11 years, you can say that in a sense they pop. And we see a lot of sunspots, which are magnetic storms in the sun. They're areas where magnetic field lines are bursting through the surface. So we're familiar with that. But there's other maxima and minima that the sun has. And we don't know actually enough about those maxima and minima to know how they've affected us. If we look at our record, there's a couple times in our planet's evolution in long-term history where it was thought that maybe this planet was one big snowball, glaciated. Now, that couldn't have happened without some type of solar influence or lack of here on the planet. So something had to happen. I know that a quiescent sun is a star that's not giving off any X flares, it's not giving off any of these massive jolts or coronal discharge, these coronal mass ejections, we call them, right? And if you don't see a CME, well, then you're not gonna see any danger to our planet, typically. I remember one CME that hit the Earth back in the 1980s, and it caused auroras that were visible all the way down to, like, Washington, D.C. Now, I live in Connecticut, and I was in a drive-in movie at the time, and I looked out of the window, and I saw these giant ribbons just coming down straight at me, like radiating away all around me. I was like, wow. So I got I called the Aurora Alert Network immediately, and forgot about the set. Never mind the movie. We're going home. I got in the car, went back home, got my camera, raced up to a mountaintop, and I started taking pictures all night long of these auroras. And it was amazing. And by 3 in the morning, we had over Connecticut an entire dome horizon to horizon that was salmon pink. And that was amazing, because it was like, it reminded me of that Star Trek episode, "For the world is hollow and I have touched the sky." And it just was surreal. Everything had a salmon pink glow to it. And it's like, wow. So this is what the sky of Mars might look like, after a dust storm. And this is, it was pretty fascinating. It was like twilight at 3 in the morning.
Very interesting.
Oh, it was great.
Now, something I was hoping you could help us understand is a little bit more about dark matter and dark energy. Maybe explain the differences and what effects, if any, it may have on our solar system or our planet.
Well, you know, dark energy and dark matter came about because of questions we had that we couldn't answer. Dark energy came about because we were trying to measure the expansion rate of the universe. And the expansion rate of the universe was nailed down by Edwin Hubble in 1929 and was called the Hubble constant. And we found out through the Planck telescope more recently that the Hubble constant isn't. It's not constant. So, and it showed that the rate of expansion is accelerating. Well, wait a minute. So now the expansion rate of the universe is getting more faster, which means that when we reverse engineered from the expansion rate of Hubble that he gave us, and we figured out the age of the universe, Well, we came to a conclusion of like 13.8 billion years for the universe. Well, if it's been expanding faster, then we got it wrong. And that means that the universe is younger. Maybe it's 12.6 billion years old and not 13.8. And if that's the case, well, then we have a whole lot to consider as far as why is it expanding and accelerating? What force is causing it to actually accelerate outward? And one of the conclusions was that maybe there was this other material that we don't understand out further called dark energy. And it's actually attracting this other matter and everything else. And so if that's the case, dark energy, which makes up over 70% of everything we know in the universe, okay, you know, say 73%. And dark energy then is going to take dark energy is going to be a huge amount of material that comprises our universe. And it's called dark because it's something we don't understand. It's not dark because it's black. It's dark because we don't know. Dark, and they'll say, like, what is it? Well, I don't know, call it dark energy. I don't know, and some energy, so it's dark. We don't know what it is. It's dark. It's a black box. We can't see inside. Okay, dark energy it is. Now, dark matter, on the other hand, is totally different. Dark matter comes from studying the rotation rates of galaxies. If you look at these galaxies with these big spiral arms, okay, you see those big spiral arms? The universe has been here for 13.8 billion years. Okay, 12.6, let's say, if that's true too. And by that point, you know, the arms should have wound up on all these spiral galaxies. If they were winding, okay, if they were going like we expect, where the internal, the stars closer to the middle go faster, like Mercury goes faster around the sun than Pluto way out here, okay, then those spiral arms should have wound up a long, long time ago, but they haven't. In fact, when we study rotational rates in galaxies, we find that it's almost like a spinning disk. The stars on the outside are going extremely fast, and the stars on the inside are going slow. Wait a minute. That violates Newtonian kinematics. What's going on? That's not right. That violates the physics we think we understand. Or does it? It doesn't if there's another matter present. A matter we can't detect directly, and it's a halo around the galaxies. And we call that dark matter because we can't see it. And we don't know what it is, so it's dark for now. And that dark matter would be enough to cause this gravitational rotation of the galaxy, where the galaxy would then look like a disk as it spins and not twist itself up. So that's dark matter versus dark energy. And dark matter is like 23% of everything we see. Dark energy is like 73%. That adds up to 96%, doesn't it? And so when you add up to 96%, at least 4%, right? So 4% of the universe is what we know. Oh, but wait, 2% of that we can't find.
Yeah, because we don't know what dark energy consists of, right?
Correct. We don't know yet. But the thing is, we do know 4% of the universe, and we know that that's what we call the baryonic matter, the matter that we, you know, electrons, protons. Okay. However, of that 4%, 2% of it we can't find. And so even what we know, we still don't have all the picture, you know. So that leads to yet another possibility. If we can't see the rest of the matter in the universe from 2 to 4%, say, then there wasn't enough mass in our universe to have actually had a Big Bang working back. So what does that mean? Well, the cosmologist will tell you, maybe it means that there was more than one universe spawned when the Big Bang occurred. And this brings up the concept of the multiverse. Is it possible that there were parallel universes created at the same time? Based on what we're seeing, it's possible. You know, and Kirk will say, Spock, there are other galaxies. I know, there's other universes, right? I mean, we think there might be. In Mirror Mirror, they went to the other universe where Spock had a beard and Kirk was a killer, you know, but he ruled the ship by assassination. Well, the truth of the matter is that, although that may not be true, we do know that without finding this extra matter, we have to have an explanation for why we are here at all. You know, and there's a whole bunch of theories as to how many different types of universes could have formed. Could they all support life? Could only ours have life? Could this universe be a particular universe where, say, the carbon atom was ubiquitous all through the universe, like hydrogen, and thus stars could form? You know, were the laws of physics different elsewhere, such that you didn't end up with, say, electrons around a proton? Might you only have nuclear particles in other universes? Might you have only heavier atoms in other universes? So it goes. There's so many different ways. But I tend to think that whereas those are all possible, go back to the simplest thing and say, I think it's possible that if a parallel universe was spawned, it was probably another universe, kind of like our own, because it was spawned from the same type of material, if the Big Bang was just a little spurt. See, maybe the Big Bang was a little pop. And there was a bigger bang out here, and we were just a little boop. You know, I don't want to be a little boop. I want to be the big guy. But, you know, it may not be that way. It may not be the case. We just might be a little spurt off of a bunch bigger bang. See?
Very interesting. Now, before we move on to UFOs and extraterrestrials, I just want to get your thoughts on Planet Nine. There's been, you know, a lot of different theories that it may be, you know, Nibiru, Planet X. What are your thoughts on Planet Nine? Does it pose any danger at all to us? Does it come close to us in the solar system? Does it even enter within the inner solar system? What is it?
Well, so far, all of the indications are that any heavier bodies, any more massive bodies that are out there, are going to be out in the Kuiper Belt, which is well beyond, you know, 30 astronomical units, beyond Neptune, and even maybe out to 50 or 100 astronomical units. Okay, and in that Kuiper Belt, there's a lot of bodies out there, a lot of bodies, a lot of icy bodies, necessarily so, because, you know, they're basically, if they get close enough to the sun, well, the sun heats up the ices and they call comets, okay? But the fact is, there are indications there might be some more massive planets in the Kuiper Belt, not planets even, but like dwarf planets possibly. Eris is one, Sedna is another, you know, now Kaor is another. But the fact is, we don't have any direct proof that we have another massive body out there. We know there's more mass out there, yes. But these things are all in an orbit that would never take them into our solar system. And the more massive they are, the less likely they will be to be knocked out of their orbit to come in here. It'd be more likely that a smaller chunk that was hit by another object in a collision or whatever could have eventually, over millions of years, make its way into the solar system where it comes from the Kuiper Belt and enters our inner solar system. But that would be, you know, an oddity. You know, many of the comets we have are from our near Earth objects. And we actually had one that came in from interstellar, from a whole other stellar system somewhere else, you know, Borisov. And so these particular objects are really strange, but, you know, they're fairly well understood. Their orbits don't pose any danger to us. And I know there are people out there that, you know, they sometimes take photos looking into the sun and they see a lens flare and they call it Nibiru. But, you know, that's just because they really need to understand their cameras better, unfortunately. And I'm happy to show them, you know, and I don't call these people names or anything like that. I just think that they've, you know, I try to explain to them what's going on and I ask them to repeat it and I show them how. And when they see that they can actually make that lens flare move at will, well, then they realize it's coming from them in their camera, and it's not something in the sky, you know. And so win, you know, science wins again, you know, and I don't always have to win. I don't like winning. I want to be able to be wrong, you know. I love being fooled by things in science, you know, just like in the UFO arena. I like to be stumped, you know. But it's one of these things where 99.9% of the things you see can be explained. And that 1% is what you look for.
Now, moving on to the UFOs, based on all your research, everything you've seen, do you think that we currently and in the past have had visitors that are coming either observe or they're whatever they're doing, they're teaching us, you know, you hear reports from abductees, contactees of different accounts with, you know, different knowledge that they've gained. But what do you think that they, first of all, are they coming visit us and what are they doing here?
My personal feeling is, based on studying exoplanets, my personal feeling is there's nothing stopping them. In fact, Stephen Hawking some years ago said, we should not announce our presence to aliens. We should kind of keep a low profile. I don't know if you remember that statement he made, except around 2.4 billion years ago, we started saying, we're here, we're here. Well, how do we do that? Well, we did that because the planet was building up an oxygen atmosphere, you know, and over the next couple billion years to the present day, the planet has maintained an oxygen atmosphere. So any alien creatures who are looking for carbon-based life like themselves know that oxygen is used to make energy for those carbon-based beings. So they're going to look for a planet with oxygen in the atmosphere. And we stand out like a beacon, like you cannot believe, if you look at our atmosphere. So frankly, for over 2 billion years, we've been announcing our presence to the universe. There's no way we're going to be hiding from them if they're going to they're going to have science that's anything like ours, but it's probably even more advanced. So we could be found by alien species without a doubt. Okay, and that's out to 2 billion light years or so. See what I mean? So we're talking, you know, well within the well far beyond the local group of galaxies, and well into galaxies that are hundreds of millions of light years away even. So we know that much of the universe, you know, a good deal of the universe could hear us and have seen us from now, by now. And what would they be doing here? Well, what they would be doing here is what we would want to do. Look what we do to the planets. We land on them. We land on Mars. And what are we doing on Mars? Every single NASA mission to Mars has one foundational element, and that is looking for sources or ancient signs of life. Every single NASA mission to Mars has been to look for life. Mars 2020, going to be looking for life. Curiosity, looking for life. Spirit and Opportunity, looking for the signs of life. Okay? It's elusive because Mars' surfaces are irradiated and we can just barely scratch the surface of Mars. But we're looking, right? Well, an alien life form coming here would, of course, find that there is life here. And what would they do? Well, maybe they want to do what we do when we find a bunch of mountain gorillas. You know, we hide in the woods and we watch. We don't let them know we're here. We kind of blend in. We use blinds to watch creatures, take their pictures. Okay, this is what we do as primitive humans. Every now and then, we tranquilize one. And we tag them, and we take measurements of their paws and stuff like that. So we, in order to learn about our own planet, we actually will go out there and tag animals, spy on them from blinds. Well, is it so far removed to think that an advanced civilization might be doing that to us? You know? And there are people that say, well, they could just hide in the moon and look at us. Well, not, I don't think so. I think that if they were going to look at us, they would watch us from the Earth itself. I think my personal feeling is if they're here, they're in our deep oceans. And I have experience with that because some decades ago, I was on a nuclear sub, not as a sailor, but as and I call it a guest, okay? But I was offered a quote-unquote ride on a nuclear sub. I went out on this ride and I got seasick because when the sub's on the surface, When it leaves Connecticut, it goes through Long Island Sound, then it goes through the Race in Long Island. It's a waterway, and gets out into the North Atlantic. So that whole time, it's going to be on the surface. And it rocks and rolls, because it is just a sewer pipe with end caps, right? Okay? And so it rolls a lot. So I got seasick. So to calm my stomach, I went into the sonar area, where it's darker and it's quiet. And I was just relaxing, trying to let my stomach calm down. And that's when the kid on the sonar, I guess I don't know how much time had elapsed since I went in there, but probably an hour or maybe two. And he yelled to the con that there was something on the sonar that was moving very fast, basically. And when the executive officer came around, he asked him what he got. And as I've said before to people, the subs are loud inside, but the Navy prides itself on that sound never getting out. So I could barely hear them. So I actually sat on the edge of my seat, kind of like in this really disturbed looking position, looking like it was something I do every day, you know, but I was right on the very corner of the chair, and the slightest bump and I would have fallen like right onto the executive officer's feet. So I'm just listening in without making it look like I am. And the executive officer, you know, saw that this thing was there and that it was gone. And he asked, how fast was that moving? And the kid kind of looked incredulous at him and said, several hundred knots, sir. Wow. And the kid had his arms out. He's like, I don't know what to do with this. Because sonar operators were typically taught to be able to classify everything, every single thing they hear. And he clearly couldn't. So the XO nodded and said, okay, log it and dog it. And the kid said, sir, yes, sir. Log it and then dog it means like dog the hatch, hide it, I think. Wow. And yeah, so I got up and I ran after the XO because me, I'm a big shot now, see, because I got this special ride. I'm important, you see. And in my head, okay, I wasn't quite like that, but I was thinking, hey, I'm sort of important. I can ask him. So I went over to the executive officer and I said to him, sir, I know what these fast movers are, because that's what the kid called it. You know, he said, con sonar, fast mover. I said, I might be able to help you with this. Is there something I can help you with? He looked at me and he said, Mr. D'Antonio. I said, yes, sir. He goes, are you having a good time? I am, sir. He says, let's keep it that way. And he turned and walked away. And so I was like this, okay, I'll be over here, slinking into a corner and hiding under the table. Yeah. So now, for the rest of that ride, I was just like, you know, out of my mind. And then about, I'd say 4 to 6 years later, I had to do a job for the Joint Chiefs in Washington. These are the people that answer to the president. And I had to do a job for those guys. I did the project. When I delivered it, I asked one of the chiefs, one who would know, I said, Chief, can you tell me what the fast mover program is? And I just like went, I can't believe I just said that in my head. And he could have said, never heard of it. I don't know what that is. You know, or like, what's that? You know, he didn't. He said, oh, I can't talk about that program. I'm sorry. I felt like I almost peed my pants, actually.
That's awesome.
That was one of those aha moments. And all the way home from Washington, I was like this. Oh, wow. I was driving like, I can't. Oh yeah. There's a bridge abutment. Avoid that. I mean, I was like driving home in a daze. And I've since learned that other navies have come out and said they've seen objects underwater. And these USOs, these unknown submerged objects, as it will be, are travel at very high speeds, you know. And I started talking about it after the Russians started talking about it. That was some years ago. Now you hear about the Nimitz incident and you hear about Dave Fravor, and he's telling you about what he saw in the air. But there was also a point where he saw one go down to the water, and there was something under the water bubbling up. Now, maybe those two are linked. Maybe that was an underwater USO in contact with an above water UFO. See? So maybe they're all linked. Maybe they're all together. And so, as such, maybe they are alien probes. Maybe they're crewed. Maybe they're not. Okay, maybe they have biological robots. Maybe grays are biological robots, for all I know. It's not outside the realm of possibility. Because if you look at our ISS, the International Space Station, okay, they have a humanoid robot up there as well. It's just a torso with a little gold faceplate and arms. And it's sort of primitive. But we're making robots in our likeness. Right? Boston Dynamics is doing the same thing. Okay? A robot that stacks boxes in a warehouse. It looks like us. It has two arms, two legs, a head, torso, pelvis. Okay? So why wouldn't aliens do the same thing? You know, it's possible that aliens could be, you know, making robots in their likeness, but maybe they are more advanced. Maybe they're biological robots, which is what Gray's might be, you know. So who knows? See, there's a lot of possibilities that I'm open to because, I don't know, it's been very enlightening looking at the universe and looking at how many other possibilities there are for planets. You know, did you know that in our galaxy alone, there's one estimate that says maybe there's 25 million other Earths like ours, just in our galaxy? That's the low estimate. There's another estimate that says as many as 40 billion other Earths. So somewhere in the middle is the truth. Maybe it's only a billion and a half. Okay, that's still a huge number of other Earths and other possibilities, you know? And I think for the people that say that there's really no way that there could be other life in the universe, okay, certainly anyone that goes to the UFO MegaCon isn't going to say that, okay? And the people that go there know. Anyone that goes to the other UFO conferences where I speak, I've spoken all over the world, you know? And I tell you this, you go to a UFO conference and you talk about science, people don't just go, oh, it's just science. They're eager to hear justification for why they think we're not alone. Because they can always say, oh, I can't believe we're not alone. You know? Now, if they read my book, right, The Populated Universe, then I give them a reason. I give them the meat to say why they think we're not alone. They can say, after reading the book, I don't think we're alone in the universe, and here's why. See, that's the thing that's been missing. So I think that it's a good way to take the argument, take it down the path of science, because science is really something we do understand. Science we get right most of the time, you know. And I think that that is very important, and that's kind of what I'm all about, is trying to just make sure that the science is there. Yes, I'm very hard on the data. When I see UFO images or videos, I'm very hard on the data. Even though I know they're probably here. What did I see underwater? Hey, who knows? You know? But it certainly wasn't something anomalous that was, you know, borne out by the crew. So clearly, this is something else. You know, there's mysteries that we don't have the answers to yet, and that makes it the most thrilling thing in the world for me.
Now, you've actually had personal, I guess you could say, contact experiences that makes this even more of a, I guess, real phenomenon for you. Would you be able to talk a little bit about these experiences that you've had? I know there may have been some implants involved.
Yeah, I had an incident happen, which I can't explain. And you got to understand, I'm a science guy. So this stuff doesn't happen to me, okay? It doesn't happen to me. And then it does. Now what do you do? I couldn't figure out what to do with it, okay? I was trying to figure out in this puny brain how to actually make heads or tails of what it was that had happened. I tried to explain it away, you know, and I had several incidents. I had one where over the course of 3 nights, I heard a knocking up in the peak of my roof.
How long ago was this?
This was 1997. Okay. And I woke up at 3 a.m. to hear like, what the heck? I heard a series of those knocks, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And the first night I heard the knocks, and I thought it was a woodpecker on crack, you know, pecking on the vinyl siding. You ain't getting anything out of there, pal. Okay, so I went back to bed. Next night, I heard it again. Okay, here it is again. Now, I had two greyhound dogs at the time, and they were sleeping underneath this window. And it was a summer night, and the window was open with the screen. And I leaned over the dogs, which were curled up on their beds right below the window, and I pushed my face against the screen to look up because something was coming, something was knocking up there. And I got a white light that flashed in my face. Now, the weird part is, I remember the flash, but you've seen flashes. They flash in your face and you go, oh, that was bright. This felt like it came from all around me. I don't know how or what or how it happened. I thought I was having some kind of medical event. And I just was holding onto the windowsill, and I kept looking. I said, oh, no, I'm blind. I'm looking out into the yard, and way in the distance was one street light, and I started to see the street light come back in. And then around it, the area around it started to bleed back in as my visual field came back. And I realized I was flash blinded. What the heck? So what flashed at me? And I opened the window, and I stuck my head out. I couldn't really see yet, but I didn't see anything up there. So I closed the window, the screen rather. And I went looking for the dogs because they were gone. I had two greyhounds named Tycho and Kepler, astronomers' dogs, go figure. And both of them were gone, just gone. They weren't on their beds. They were curled up sound asleep. But when this knocking started, they were looking up at the peak of the roof where this knocking was coming from. So when I found them, I found Tycho in the closet, sitting in the laundry pile, okay? And he wouldn't come out. And I saw Kepler sitting outside of the room, down on her haunches in that suspicious pose, like her head down low, ears back. So she wasn't too excited either. And I was thinking, wow, what is that? What was that? So I did what anybody does when they have something really crazy, you know, happen like that. I went back to bed and went to sleep. Go figure, why'd I do that? Next day I went to work like nothing happened. And then I came home that night, and in the middle of the night, I wake up again. I'm like, oh, come on, again? I'm thinking. And this time, I go to turn my head to look out the window, and I can't move my head. So I'm thinking, oh, I'm in a hypnopompic state. I'm in a state where your mind and your body are kind of at that sleepy zone. And I've actually learned to enjoy that state. I can put myself there and
like sleep paralysis a little bit?
Yes, exactly. And I've learned to put myself there and control it, you know. And so I said, oh, you know, this is kind of nice. I like this. However, when I did that, I said I couldn't move my head. I figured, okay, I'm in that paralysis mode. I'll just ride it out because it's really kind of nice. But then I tried to move my eyes and look over there with my eyes. Ooh, my eyes were frozen. I couldn't. They were stuck facing forward. I couldn't look over here. And I'm looking, I want to look over here. I couldn't do this. I couldn't do that. I could not move my eyes. I couldn't move my head. And then in my peripheral vision, I saw something cross in front of the window, you know, in the dark. And now I'm like, what's that? And then all of a sudden, it's coming toward me. And it's like, I'm in my bed, but it's moving toward me. And I couldn't look directly at it, but it extends something. I'll use this for lack of a better object, okay? It extends something toward me like a glowing, it had a glowing, it was like a wand. It was like a white translucent thing. And it was doing this in front of my face. I couldn't look at it. I could only look straight ahead. And it was doing this. And then bam, it was morning. And I couldn't breathe. And I was face down. And I quickly push off the pillow. And I see why I couldn't breathe. I was lying in a pool of my own blood from my sinuses. Something had happened. And it felt like I got punched in the face. And I knew what happened before, the night before. Something did something, and I didn't like it. I knew that I was trying to fight it in my mode there. And I'm wondering if I actually fought it off. That's what I thought at the time. And so whenever something crazy like that happens, you know, people do, they just go in the shower and then forget about it and go to work, which is exactly what I did. And that's not what happened. I mean, you should be able to say, I got to call someone. This is crazy. Call the police, whatever. I was assaulted. I mean, this is something, right? But no, I didn't even put urgency to it at all. Even though I couldn't breathe out of this sinus from that moment forward for 2 years. You know, that day I couldn't breathe out of this and never came back until I went to a doctor. And he looked up there, an ear, nose, and throat surgeon. He looked up there and he goes, wow. He says, you've got something huge up there. And I went, really? I was more like, really? Okay. And he goes, yeah. He says, I think I can get it out. But let's schedule time to pull it out. Okay. So when I finally went in, he sprayed and then he yanked it out literally. And it looked like it was the size of two of my thumbs together, two of my thumbs. And he put it in a jar, okay, and said, I got to send this down to pathology. We're going to get it biopsied. He says, I'm sure it's just a sinus polyp, but he says, it's actually one of the biggest ones I've ever seen. And I said, okay, let me ask you a question. Is it possible, I said to him, that these things can seed around a foreign object? You know? And he said, you mean like a machinist who might get a metal splinter in his nose? I said, exactly. And he went, yeah, I think so. He goes, why? And I told him part of the story I just told you. And he laughed. Ah, he goes, I'm sure it's not aliens. I go, no, no, of course not. You know, of course not. Who would ever say that? You know, science guy, right? And because he knew I was into science and working for the Navy as a model maker. So he actually said, give me a call in a week and I'll let you know what turns up. All right. A week later, I call. I call and she answers, the receptionist answers. I go, hi, this is Mark D'Antonio. I'm calling. Oh, hang on. Doctor has to talk to you. Oh gosh. Whenever the doctor has to talk to you, it's never good news. I'm thinking, I got like a head disease. My head's going to fall off or something. He gets on the phone and says, hey, Mr. D'Antonio, just want to let you know, I'm sure that what we took out of your sinus was just a benign polyp. Well, you didn't get a report yet. Well, no. I said, well, so was it going to take a little longer? He says, well, and he said, and I quote, this has never happened in my office before, but they've lost the sample. You lost it. And he goes, yeah. And so I rolled over. I didn't want to make a big deal of it because I already knew in my head what might have happened because there's a reason. And I said, oh, okay, but you think it's benign? Yep, okay. Thanks anyway. Okay, thank you. Well, we had talked earlier, him and I, and I had a sneaky suspicion that something may be happening with that sample. So 4 years later, I had to go to him for something totally unrelated. And when I was there, on the sign-in sheet, I put down what I do. At the time, I had a fairly high clearance. You know, I had it all through the 90s, actually, and before. And I wrote that I do special Navy work. That's all I say, because publicly, I don't talk about that. And he says, oh, when he came in, he says, he was reading that sheet. It's called an intake sheet. Usually I put on there that I'm pregnant and nursing, okay, because I have fun with those things, you know. Who reads them? How did I know the doctor actually does? Well, he walks in, he's reading the sheet, and he goes, special work for the Navy. I said, yeah, I do classified work. You know, I do ship models for new models of subs that are going to be out in maybe 30 years. And he goes, wow, he goes, I was in the Navy too. He says, I just gave up my top secret clearance this year. Really? Yeah. This was 4 years after my event. And I knew exactly what happened. See, when you have a clearance, for national security reasons, you need to, by law, report anything, no matter how remote the possibility, to authorities if you think there's a possibility that national security could be compromised through what you know. He had to call someone, probably down in Washington, and say, yeah, I don't know if this means anything, but I got a guy who came in and had this weird event, and he said, you know, that maybe something was shoved up his nose or whatever. And he didn't react to me. So he probably got the guy in Washington to basically come up and take the thing away. See, so yes, I've had weird things happen.
Very interesting. Now, did you ever have any type of like regression or anything done to find out exactly what went on during that incident?
No, I've never done anything like that. I'm not averse to it. I just have never done it. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Now, I mean, it's just the way it is. I don't, no time really, you know, I mean, I was, I had someone try to regress me once, well, hypnotize me, so to speak. I know what it is psychologically, what it really is. And it was a dismal failure. And it was a professional, too. So, you know, embarrass him. You know, but, yeah, go ahead.
Now, I was going to ask you, when it comes to analyzing UFO footage, is there any that stand out as really compelling that you couldn't explain as something, a natural phenomenon or anything that would occur normally?
Well, you know, the Nimitz, you know, the gimbal video of from the Nimitz incident, the tic-tac, and the fast movers that they called it, you know, that was skimming the ocean. All three of those videos I analyzed and found that they weren't doing anything out of the ordinary for what we saw. Okay. Apparently there's more that we haven't seen. But what they released wasn't earth shattering. You know, the fast mover that they calculated, they saw down, you know, running near the water, that people say was moving thousands of miles an hour. Well, I calculated it to be moving about 175 miles an hour, which is the fast speed of a twin-engine turboprop, possibly a drug runner. Okay, so I don't know for that. Okay, but it's all the stuff we hear about from the pilots who talk about it. I know some of these people personally and their friends, and you know, their lives have been ruined by the fact that they've had to stay quiet on this stuff. And now that they have a chance to talk, it's like a floodgate opening up and they can finally talk about it. And they've wanted to for years, you know? So you have to look at that and say, that means something. What we saw probably wasn't very compelling on the video that was released. I want to see the video that wasn't released, you know? And, but that's one. Another one I saw, was a piece of footage from 1950s on a 16-millimeter movie camera taken by a father who was with his daughter, actually, and he was doing some kind of work on at a stadium or some such thing, and he actually panned on two bright objects that were streaking across the sky really fast. And these two bright objects were very compelling looking. I thought they were really cool. And for the fact that if they were meteors, you would see smoke if they were entering Earth's atmosphere. Because if they were glowing, that means they're burning and you'd see a trail behind them, you know, called a train. You'd see a meteor train. And there wasn't. You know, they were just bright silver. So they're moving at a really, really fast speed, but we don't know how far away they were. To know, but that was very compelling. And that footage is only 3 seconds long, you know? So I think that's very compelling. Some are not. I mean, there's some things like I saw, I got a case the other night where there was these lights in the sky and they were coming down like this. And then they started to do these circling patterns, you know, and some of them went higher and then lower apparently. Well, I look at this and said, are there any baseball stadiums nearby? Well, yeah. Okay. Can you check to see if there was an aerial skydiving team doing a night jump into the stadium for the fans? And that's exactly what it was. We were seeing flares on their legs, you know, because otherwise you can't see them. And some of them actually have illuminated canopies. So really, you know, really cool. They look really neat. And they look unearthly, you know. But those are some things we do understand, things like that. Yeah, so, but there are things that we don't. And the things that we don't understand are the things that I'm after. You know, I work with a movie visual effects legend, Douglas Trumbull. Good friend. This guy, he did Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He was a guy that did all the special effects. He did Blade Runner. 2001 A Space Odyssey was Stanley Kubrick, for crying out loud. Star Trek, the motion picture. And beyond, okay? Silent Running with Bruce Dern and Brainstorm, okay? So all his history in visual effects and my business in visual effects collided, you know, eventually, but not with our visual effects. It collided because he's a UFO hunter like I am. And he created a system to try and hunt UFOs called UFOTOG, okay? And that was a Humvee with a big telescopic array that came out, would swing around and look for anomalous objects in the sky. Well, we got together after I was on an NPR show. I did this NPR show, and the host walked me out and said, I got to get you out with Doug Trumbull next time. Went, ooh, Doug Trumbull. Oh, I'm shaking because why? You know, I've always wanted to meet that guy. You know, I've modeled all of my visual effects company after what he's done. He's a genius. Well, it turns out that Doug is an hour from me here in Connecticut. He's up in Massachusetts, just over the border. And I wrote him an email as soon as I got home about who I am. I'm a UFO guy. I saw your UFO tag. I think it's really cool. He went to my website, fxmodels.com, and he saw all the special effects and video visual stuff I did. And he wrote me back a half hour later with a two-page email. First time I ever heard from this man. And I was stunned. It's like, oh, he wrote me. I'm thinking, I'm so scared. I can't move. And this is amazing. And he said, I went to your website, excellent in every respect. He said, I think we can use you right now on a production we're doing. Please come up at your earliest convenience and let's see if we can put you to work. I was like, ha ah! And I went up and very tentatively shook his hand. Hello, Mr. Trumbull, you know. And then I worked on a Burger King commercial for the next 17 days. I was supposed to do one thing. I ended up doing about 14 different things. He never talked to me once, so I figured, all right, this is cool. I got to meet the guy anyway. And on the last day of shooting, I was about to leave, and he said, you know, to everybody, hold on, everybody, just want to make an announcement. This is Mark D'Antonio, and he's joining our team. I was like, oh. He was watching. He saw everything I did, and he actually recounted everything I did, watching from a distance. I had no idea. And that started a friendship that's lasted 7 years now. We've been working. In fact, today he's contacted me. We're working on a movie about Nikola Tesla, you know, father of electricity, basically. And it took us to Niagara Falls, where we filmed Niagara Falls from very special locations, from helicopters, from so we can actually, and from the ground, underground even. And you know, so it's been amazing, you know, working with Doug. And we film in 3D. Very fast frame rates, 120 frames per second, full 4K in 3D. You swear you're looking through a window at the real world, you know, when we're done. It's just beautiful. And so I helped Doug with all manner of things, from visual effects to creating electronic rigs for him to help shoot some of these things. Today's thing was trying to help him figure out the best way to illustrate a copper atom and all the electrons in a copper atom. There's 29 of them. So how do you show all the electrons spinning around? Okay. While you have a nucleus, which is a proton. And, you know, he didn't want to hear, I guess, that, you know, well, there are no electrons that are a particle. They're actually a cloud. And he's like, oh, well, how do I show that? You know? So we found a way to show that, you know, so in other words, so he's really good. But the UFO hunting thing is called UFOTOG. That was his original. And when I got together with him, I said to him, we need to find something easier than this big Humvee. He goes, yeah, I know. The Humvee is too expensive, and it's only one. I can't imagine having 400 of these things or 1,000 of these things running around, you know, because they can't go everywhere. I said, I know, but what if we make them like a platter? What if we made up a 24-inch platter that actually had these remote sensing systems on it, and they would just call our cell phones when it saw something? And he says, wow, that's kind of what I was thinking. And so we've been embarking on this. It was originally called UFOTOG 2, okay? And now we're calling it the AADS, the Aerial Anomaly Detection System, because we discovered that when you have UFO in the name of your science project, no one wants to fund you. So AADS can see asteroids. It can see meteors, it can see other anomalies in the sky, aircraft. And if we know where in the sky it is and we have an access to an actual live ADS-B database of planes, we can exclude planes and say, well, that's just a plane. We know it. We don't even have to alert anybody about it. But, you know, we're going to be piggybacking on GPS satellites, and this already works since we got this working, where you actually, you know, your UFO detection systems will actually send an alert up to the GPS satellites, and they'll bounce down to our cell phones and our pockets wherever we are on Earth, and we'll get the alert. So this is where we're heading, you know. And that's Doug and I working on that now.
You just mentioned that, you know, whenever you use the word UFO, you're not likely to get funding. Now, in closing tonight, I'm just wondering your thoughts on the future. Do you think that with everything happening with, you know, Navy admittance to the UFO phenomenon, letting the pilots talk about it, everything that's happening in the mainstream media, that I guess academia will one day accept that, yeah, UFOs are a thing, and then they won't look at people like yourself as the, and myself as tinfoil hat wearing, you know, people that are not legitimate.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I have like 14 different talks that I do around the world, and one of them I actually wear a tinfoil hat, and I discuss having a sighting and how the newspaper guys gave me this really cool tinfoil hat. Okay. And they said, always wear it, you know, whenever you're talking about your sighting, because that's what people who see UFOs do, you know. And at the end of the talk, I take the tinfoil hat off because I've shown everybody that they're not the crazy things that the news people make it out to be. And I crunch it up and throw it away. And that, you know, usually brings a lot of applause because, you know, of course, they're there for that very reason. They don't want to be, marginalized because of that. As far as where the media goes, I have to say, we have to make the media aware through science that UFOs are a normal thing. Academia, believe it or not, is actually already on the way. They have started to make some gestures from various institutions that indicate that they think that there is probably some intelligent life out there. They don't have proof, just like I don't. You know, I only have my experiences. I can't say for sure what they are. I think that's part of the bargaining chip that the alien race has with us, is that we can't recognize them as good as we think. But the fact is, you know, academia is already coming a long way. You know, if I'll give you an example, when I got my astronomy degree, I was having an argument with my director of the observatory at the time. And I told him, and I said these words, I said, I think it's a populated universe, you know. All right. And that ended up becoming the title of my book. Okay. Years later, oddly. And he says, populated universe, Mr. D'Antonio, why do you say that? And I said, because look at us. We're carbon-based. We're symmetric. Every life form has DNA. It's a template that the universe has plunged down to here, to this planet in the habitable zone of this star. There's liquid water here. Water is the universal solvent. You know, if there's life that's going to happen, it usually requires water. So there's other planets like ours out there. Now, at that point, we hadn't confirmed a single exoplanet yet. Okay? So he said to me over his glasses, and he puts his glasses on, and he goes like this. And he goes, Mr. D'Antonio, get back in the observatory and get back on the parallax program. Leave Captain Kirk to us. And he turns and walks away. And I said, okay. So some years later, actually those years were 1987, we had confirmed an exoplanet. I went back to see him. And I walked into his office, and he was on the phone, so I was quiet. I peeked around the door, and I saw him on the phone, and I smiled at him. And he looks at me, and he smiles and waves, and he puts his hand over the mouthpiece, and he goes, it was only one planet. I said, just the beginning. And he's like, and he goes back in his call. So, you see, now academia is saying things like, let's go look for life in our solar system. We found life at the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. We found life off the Juan de Fuca Ridge out in the Pacific. Deep ocean, 2,500 meters or more down, we find life in these little oases around these sulfide chimneys. Let's actually see if there's life elsewhere in the solar system now. I think Enceladus is a good bet. I think Europa is a good bet. Maybe Titan. Maybe the bottom, maybe deep below the surface of Mars, you know, on the South Pole. How about that? See, so academia is starting to figure that out. You know, they're starting to kind of fall into place. So little by little, they march toward the time when they will just say, oh, yeah, well, of course there's life on other planets. You know? And the fact is, we've kind of suspected all along, because NASA has been hunting for life around Mars ever since the Mariner probes, you know, and that was a long time ago, right? So we're talking about, you know, an ancient history of flirting with the prospects of life, even in our solar system.
We live in fascinating times. I'm super excited for what the future holds. I think that we're entering, you know, one of the most important times in human history, really, with everything happening. Mark, thank you so much for coming by tonight. That was fascinating information. And before you head out, let everyone know where they can find your work, websites, stuff like that.
Sure. You can, I'm MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network's Chief Photo and Video Analyst. Of course, you can contact me through MUFON. In my website for my model work is actually fxmodels.com. That's letter F, letter X, M-O-D-E-L-S.com. You can also find me streaming online on clear nights with our remote observatories, and that's at SkyTour Livestream. So SkyTour, one word, Livestream, and that's on YouTube. Astroimaginglive.com is another website where you can find that same stream being broadcast. You can also go to Amazon and search for The Populated Universe. You can find the book in three different formats, an ebook for $9.99, a $20 black and white 6x9 version, and then the big beautiful color version 8x10, and that's $38.50 from Amazon. But I've had a number of people already read that, and they think it's really a good book, and the color, especially the larger format book, is really, really, and they like it a lot. So, good book. It's The Populated Universe.
Very good. Well, thank you again, Mark, and I'd love to have you back on in the future.
Well, thank you. And I'll see you at UFO MegaCon next month.
Definitely. Looking forward to it.
Right.
All right. Well, you have an excellent night.
Okay. Hey, thank you very much. This is fun.